comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks.
Let's use this as a jumping off point and talk a little bit about some of the legal cases that have actually been brought against the rule, because I'm sure we'll just devolve again into these similar conversations about fairness. But Professor Zielinski is a professor at Cardozo School of Law, I believe,
yes.
At the time that he brought the case.
Still
a professor at Cardozo School of Law. And he brought a case against the convenience rule back in 2003, and I think it was from tax years even prior to that, possibly 95, 96, 97, something like that. Essentially, he challenged the constitutionality of the law. He was working 3 days a week at Cardozo. Working 3 days a week at Cardozo, which, if you don't know, is in Manhattan. He was teaching classes there, but he was also doing work at home in Connecticut. He wanted to be able to count those Connecticut days not as New York days so that his apportionment would be fair and the fraction would be proportional to the work that he felt that he was doing that was attributed to Connecticut. That's the very short version of the facts. And he lost. He made it all the way to the New York Court of Appeals. And he lost. The rule still exists. It was found to be constitutional for many reasons that we are going to discuss. But he tried to get it before the Supreme Court, and they said, not interested.
Okay. Let me start at this point, because it is, what, an oft-spoke trope that bad facts make bad law. And I would say, because I read the decision of the Court of Appeals again before participating in this, and it seems to me that the Court of Appeals as a whole, based on its decision, has a fairly low opinion of law professors. Because they kept on going back to this their primary job was teaching students. And for the life of me, I think, like, that's not their part. They do that like 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
They've got to prepare their lessons. They have to grade papers.
How about research, publication? Research, like
publish or perish, right?
Yeah. The things that they actually get like paid for and retained for in tenure are not teaching. Like teaching is almost like anyone who's ever worked for a university understands that teaching is such a small percentage of, and not to discredit great teachers at the university level, because sometimes it's teaching college classes is undervalued because research and all of that extra stuff is so disproportionately weighted at most universities. So I agree. They really were just like, oh, all you do is you teach 3 days a week. That's
it. And all those articles that you write and all the other stuff that you do, that's to your benefit. That's to increase, you know, your reputation in educational, you know, cocktail parties, I guess. And to me, no, it's you're increasing the reputation of the institution, of the Cardozo Law School. And every time you do another law review article, it makes Cardozo Law School more cool. And even though Cardozo Law School has, you know, its campus in New York, a bunch of the students don't come from New York,
yeah,
right? Like you're marketing to students all around the world. And the cooler the school is, because, you know, you've got a cool faculty, the easier it is to attract high-quality students.
I get it. I personally feel like his case, from the perspective of the facts that were, you know, that he presented to the court, It's a pretty New York-centric set of facts as compared to a lot of people you see with convenience test issues. Let's say you work for a Fortune 100 company with offices all across the face of the earth, and every day you interact with people from different states, different countries. you just happen to be originally based in the New York office, but you're working remotely from Connecticut or pick a state, right? Like, that's a much different set of facts than a law school that has one campus, physical in Manhattan. Yes, it has some interstate commerce and some global reach from marketing perspective, but his facts are just somewhat hemmed insofar as, you know, he's got basically Connecticut, he's got New York, maybe some conferences he goes on someplace else, you know, so it's like a, you're kind of starting from this perspective that it's a very New York job. Not that that automatically taints it one way or the other, but a lot of situations and fact patterns you see today, it is not a New York job. There just so happens to be like a New York default someplace in your employment. But in reality, the people you report to, who report to you, you know, kind of your work location are very scattered. But New York's still kind of putting its hooks in to a lot of those cases.
Yeah, it's wild to me in the modern setting, because how many clients have we dealt with who are like, oh, yeah, you know, I used to live in New York. We don't really have an office there. Like, we have a WeWork, but like, people are scattered all over. But like, that WeWork is enough usually for the state to say like, boom, New York office, you work in New York, your services are, you know, New York centric, you're deriving the benefits of New York City. And like, it's just so, it's antiquated, in my opinion.
I don't want to shang out the podcast, but maybe we have a second podcast on this topic. Around the same time as Zelensky, there's a case, Huckabee, kind of in the same vintage, who presented actually a quite different set of facts than Zelensky, but the similar legal arguments, constitutional base, and just around the same legal issues. He was a Tennessee resident who telecommuted 75%+ of the time, I think they said, maybe more than that, to a New York-based employer. He was an IT professional. And that's closer to what we're seeing now, right? Like,
yes.
You are a telecommuter who work and live and, you know, are kind of allowed to be in Tennessee, but you're getting taxed in New York. And it's a little bit like that guy's job. He worked for like probably a global company, you know, he probably had contacts everywhere. He's probably IT professionaling, working for his, whatever you call it, you know, for people with problems all across the world or country. I don't know, you know? So it's one of those things where even just talking about who should reboot their case, I hope Zelensky's successful. But I'll keep you out of, if he's still working for that company, maybe retired now, but you know, if someone like that, you know, could rethink about it as well.
One, it's an interesting thing, because now that the convenience rule is more at, you know, kind of the forefront of a lot of people's lives, because remote work became more popular during COVID, like, we're more aware of the workarounds and the exceptions. Like, a lot of people are just getting assigned to a new office, opening offices in the new state, working 0 days in New York, which is an exception under the Hayes case. And so there's probably not a ton of people out there who are in that position where they can, you know, they're like, well, I'm still doing exactly what I was doing before. And now there's just more awareness that the rule like kind of sucks. So reboot the case, right?
So there's another analogy I want to draw here. And that is, COVID also highlighted the concept that the business doesn't need to be near its clients. So it's not just, you know, it's not just people that are now remote from their employers. Businesses have decided they don't need to be, you know, wherever they used to be. So it's not just the employees that are exiling themselves to lower tax jurisdictions. The businesses are doing the same thing. Maybe at a slightly slower pace, but I feel the drain. It's not anecdotal, because you've seen a whole bunch of hedge funds slide down to Palm Beach or Tampa, and other service businesses are doing the same migration. So it's not just employees that are doing the dance. It's their employers are doing it too, and that solves the problem, right? If the office is down in Palm Beach, and you're assigned to the Palm Beach office, you don't have to worry about the convenience rule.
Yeah. Maybe that's the conclusion that's reached at the end of the day, is that these businesses are just like, yeah, like, we've had it with this rule. We're just going to open more offices and we're going to just use the workarounds that already exist. But I admire that someone like Professor Zelensky is bringing this case back and has basically held a grudge against this rule for, what are we at, 20 years now since the last case? Like, I mean, that's some hardcore, like, V for Vendetta level attempted revenge. Like, he's gonna bring it down, or be dragged away kicking and screaming.
I think he wants a doctrine named after him, like the Zelensky Doctrine. That's good, you know. Hey, that's really when you're a law professor, that's what you're shooting for.
That would be the ultimate, just like, you know, if you're a professional athlete, like you go in the Hall of Fame, what's the professorial equivalent of the Hall of Fame?
You got a
your
doctrine.
Own doctrine, yeah.
you got to do that.
But, you know, so it's interesting because in that first case, they talked a lot about fair apportionment and the benefits that employees were receiving and to the point of a greater level of disconnection in the place where your office might actually be. Like, I mean, they talked about, you know, getting the benefits of like fire, police, emergency health services, public utilities. And I think that notion is really stretched at this point.
Well, so again, I think Professor Zielinski has a problem relitigating the fair apportionment piece, but I don't think the fairly related to the benefits provided by the state piece, which seems to be the direction he's going in with the new litigation, has been exhaustively analyzed by the court. And I think that's where the court went off the rails a little bit, because I got to tell you, I'm pretty sure I get more benefit from police protection in New York State and fire protection in New York State and the roads in New York State and the schools in New York State than Professor Zielinski gets, right? Yeah. My kids went to public school, go Blue Devils, and I daily get the benefit generally from the infrastructure here in New York State, and he doesn't. And why is that fair?
Yeah, man, I think that's like, it gets back to the most basic sense of jurisdictional fairness, even in a legal sense, that, you know, when you're not within, and again, talking about individuals, not businesses, like when you're not within a state's borders, what is the extent that they have jurisdiction over you? And this is always something that in the practice of law and the study of law has been under a microscope. Like, people are very concerned about a state that they don't live in, that they don't operate in, or that they have minimal contacts with, exercising some sort of jurisdiction over them and bringing them into some sort of legal proceeding or taxing them, et cetera.
Well, I was going to say, Chris and I, in particular, on behalf of Hodgson Russ and on behalf of clients and others, and just, you know, we've seen the erosion of the concept of, you know, bright lines of what amount of contacts you must have with a state before that state can subject you to tax. It's been a steady decline for the same period of time that Professor Zielinski's been challenging this. I'm not sure exactly what relation the Wayfair case has to his arguments now, but, you know, the idea, I think, is that the Supreme Court of the United States has continued to allow for less physical contacts with the jurisdiction before that jurisdiction can subject you or your transactions to tax. And if it's not the Supreme Court of the United States, it's high courts of other states for years who are, you know, looking at businesses that have, I think, Chris, what's the word we use, substantial economic contact. You know, the idea is that it doesn't surprise me that, you know, taxpayers face more and more today taxation without much contacts on those roads, on those highways, you know, crossing those bridges. Should it be that way? Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I think that the headwinds are there for taxpayers, that remote contacts, you know, can suffice in some ways with a limit, right? There still has to be the due process connection. There still has to be, for example, if Professor Zielinski has taught 50 classes in New York, he's subject to suit in New York, right? He has due process with New York from the perspective of minimum contacts. He's here working 50 days a year. No one would deny that. No court would probably say no, that there's a due process issue here. You can't bring suit here against him. Right? Like, you know, so that's probably his base facts, probably more than that, right? Two semesters a year. I don't know. To me, I agree with you. There's an issue with regards to services received. I'm just not sure exactly the bifurcation of those services. When you look at, you know, if Zielinski was selling t-shirts and he sold 200 of them to South Dakota for a total of $500, he would be subject to tax in South Dakota for sales tax on those sales, remitting it to South Dakota. You know, like, that's ridiculous. But that's the rule right now. That's
But he wouldn't be subject to tax on the shirts that he sold in Connecticut, I think is the point, right? Yeah, he'd be subject to sales tax in South Dakota, yeah, on the South Dakota shirts. But South Dakota is not saying, well, we want all of your income everywhere.
Right. I think that's true. But insofar as, well, yeah, the net income you would as a Connecticut resident, but the business you wouldn't as a market-based sourcing state.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. it's a mess, no doubt about it. I look at it and say, you know, just it seems to me like taxpayers have taken some losses recently with Wayfair and other, you know, kind of cases eroding those boundaries of what's required before you can be drawn in and taxed like this.
I would be really interested to see what would happen with this rule before the current incarnation. And as of recording, it's 2022. So if you're listening to this episode 30 years from now, and this is a very famous podcast, and I'm a world-renowned lawyer, I don't know what the makeup of the Supreme Court is. But in today's world, the current makeup of the Supreme Court, because it's conservative-leaning, the juxtaposition of being taxpayer-friendly and states' rights-friendly could make this a particularly interesting matter, because conservative justices tend to be pro-federalism, pro-rights of states to craft their own laws, and at the same time, they tend to be more taxpayer-friendly, and they might not be so fond of a law that is, in our opinion, in my opinion, anti-taxpayer because it has more reach than I feel it should.
You know, I don't know, some of it also, not that, you know, just require probably a little deeper thinking than the happy minute version of this.
No doubt.
But you know, just thinking also in that same vein, and I don't actually know the answer, Chris, I'm curious to know, and Joe, yours too, but, you know, there's also headwinds against the dormant commerce clause as a concept. You know, this idea that, you know, Complete Auto and other cases that have gone back and kind of read a gloss into the interstate commerce clause that states can't essentially prohibit. There's not like this dormant commerce clause that even, the words are not in the document.
Yeah.
You can't read them to exist there, that, you know, the states have these limitations from competing against it.
Which again, with a textualist leaning Supreme Court, you would think that they would say, not there, not real. Like, that's been the way that a lot of these cases have been going
recently.
The problem
might be is if Zelensky's saying, well, I got prong four of the complete auto test or whatever he's saying, it's like, well, that's a dormant commerce clause analysis.
Sure.
You know, like, if it doesn't exist, what are you fighting on? You know what I mean? I don't know exactly where that stands, but I think there's been talk of that since Quill, you know, and there's still talk of that today just in terms of should that exist as a theory that impacts state taxation.
So I think it would be, you know, if I were asked by a justice and I were arguing before the Supreme Court, what if we told you that dormant due process is dead? And look, you should have figured that out in the Wayfair case. I would say, well, then, or I'm sorry, dormant interstate commerce clause is dead. I would say, well, but this is still, you know, the due process clause still exists, and this is fundamentally unfair. And due process at its, like, base foundation is a fairness issue. And you have not, you know, and New York's rule in this regard is fundamentally unfair. And I would do that pivot. And I think I might get some traction there. I don't know.
I think that could work. I think that this prong is as close to the due process commerce clause overlap as you get. Like, what amount of benefit are you getting from these services? It's kind of mixed there, which constitutional prong you get. I'm just struggling with someone listening to this podcast 30 years from now. Like, they're either doing like a deep dive into one of us for investigatory purposes, or like, I don't, you know.
I'd like to think, you know.
Could it be? Could there be a set of facts for someone listening?
Perhaps in 30 years, I'm the chairman of the firm. You know, you guys are, well, actually, Dan, we're not that different in age, but, you know, Chris, there's a plaque on the front of the firm honoring, like, his
memorial
great
plaque.
I didn't want to say it. You know, and so maybe we argued this case in front of the Supreme Court, so some law student is going back and listening to this podcast to understand where we were at before the case even got brought. That's what I'd like to think.
It's not impossible.
You know.
I just want a nickel for every time that somebody uses the phrase Zelensky doctrine.
There we go. And you know, who knows if Zelensky will fight you on the copyright to that. But we'll be interviewing him in the future. And I do think this episode will be released before the interview of Professor Zelensky. So we're actually going to get, and not a one-on-one, but three of us from Hotch and Russ interviewing him. So we'll get to understand some more about his position. We'll talk to him a little about the history of his legal efforts against the convenience rule, but about what he's doing now and what's changed and why he thinks his legal argument is in a better position. And, you know, Chris, you alluded to it a little bit. Like, he's just taking a different approach this time, I think. And hopefully his facts are better. Some of the facts, I read the opinion as well before we sat down for this. And some of the things, like his contract not denoting any relationship with Connecticut or any services outside of, like, the teaching with New York, like, that hurt him. They slam him on that pretty bad.
Yeah, but at the same time, they pay him for a sabbatical. Like, I think it's, again, I go back to, I think that the court as a whole indicated to me that it had a fairly low opinion of law professors.
Which is just unfair from them, you know? But it's a different court.
So.
It's a different court makeup, so, you know, the current court is not to blame.
That's right. When we get there.
Yes. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like this is a pretty good place to wrap up this Happy Minute discussion, unless anybody had any last lingering thoughts that they wanted to put out into the internet sphere.
Just two, I suppose, quick ones. Joe mentioned at the beginning that this concept comes from a place called the Jug. You can't see him, but Chris is wearing a shirt that says Jug on it right now. True to his roots, he's an expert sailor, brings him to that place often. Just wanted that to be known for the record. And then, you know, I'm really hopeful, and this maybe is a little bit off topic or it's just a different conversation, but there are a lot of interesting convenience test cases that are to come with regards to mandated office closures in New York and what employees have done. I think that that's absolutely not convenience when an employee is sent home by the government because they cannot come to work in New York. In New York has taken the position in writing that they believe that that to continue to be a convenience test issue. If you're telecommuting from a surrounding state back to a New York employer, even if that office is closed, that's just ridiculous. And to me, it's an extension of this law that exceeds, I think, the breadth of the regulation. It's not a law, it's a regulation that it creates the convenience test in the first instance. But I think it's probably, if Zelensky doesn't have those facts, probably as exactly, Cardozo probably closed. But not in his original petition, I think is 19 pre-COVID. So I just think that, you know, this test is evolving. The facts that apply to it are evolving. Each taxpayer stands on their own. But I think we're going to hopefully see some headway where someone's successful against it to kind of limit its reach is my hope.
Sure. And I would say that that's what the, New Hampshire versus Massachusetts was all about, right? That was purely just a reaction to COVID, that Massachusetts passed that regulation. It was temporary only, and it only applied during the period when you were prohibited from being in your office as a result of COVID. And, you know, one of the, I think, issues that the Supreme Court was thinking about when they denied the ability to file a complaint to New Hampshire was, you know, this is mooted. By the time they got to the court, the regulation had already timed out.
Yeah. So some real taxpayer with real facts, not a state at like a hypothetical level, will bring a case with a full record, set of facts, documents, contracts, et cetera. You know, maybe someone gives them a better shake.
Yeah, and we'll see. And I think the most interesting part to me is if the rule is upheld, if it's found to be constitutional, you know, do other states end up just kind of following suit? And then as we alluded to earlier, you know, the pain of this particular rule is kind of alleviated because other states are doing it and giving credits for that type of thing. And maybe we get to a good place inevitably, or maybe we don't, and we live in taxpayer hell, as my uncle would say.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we should stay in taxpayer hell until I retire, because as you know, nothing pays the bills like arguing about whether things are fair.
Well, you know, and as the last point is, we didn't spend a lot of time on it. I think it's probably for a different discussion, but there are ways around the convenience test, like tried and true ways around it, where, you know, in other ways are just, you know, kind of try and take advantage of those. You know, there's a handful that are tested and that New York has green-lighted with memorandum and otherwise, that you don't have to kind of just take it on the chin per se if it could affect your negative like that. There's solutions in theory. But it'd be great if Professor Zelensky or someone undercut it. You know what I mean? Just took it out of the leg and it crumbled, as opposed to needing some solution around it that is there but maybe problematic.
But while we're waiting for that to happen, if you want one of those solutions, please call Joe or Dan. You can get their information at www.hotsandrust.com and click on our professionals. pull-down menu, and you'll be able to find their contact information.
Yeah, the spelling of my name is right in the title of the podcast, so look up at your computer screen or down at your phone, and you'll figure it out.
Kelly's really confusing. It's spelled just like it's pronounced.
Well, guys, thank you so much. This was a terrific episode, a terrific first iteration of the Happy Minute. Cheers to many more of these, and cheers to, you know, the potential downfall of the convenience rule.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans.
The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.